Okay, turn to the book of Proverbs. We've been in Proverbs for several weeks now, and we've taken one major proverbial topic at a time, as you know, and we've tried to dig into Proverbs and really the rest of the Bible to see what it says. So today we come to wisdom in government, what Proverbs has to say about government and politics. What I'd like to do is give you 2 points of introduction, and then we'll get into 3 main points, which each try to solve some kind of dilemma or some kind of question that I'd anticipate we'd have as we come to biblical information about government and in our context of American culture, American politics, things of that sort. A couple points of introduction. One, we have to contextualize Proverbs and what it's saying about government. We have to understand up front where the context of Proverbs on government is different than our context. Of course, most obvious is that Proverbs is talking about government almost exclusively in terms of a king. And not a democratic king or queen like England has today. In Proverbs, king means a true monarchy. So in some of these verses we'll look at, they refer to a king, and they may not apply to our context in America much at all because we don't have a king. Other verses refer to a king, and you could simply substitute president for the word king, and it would fit. It would make sense. It would connect to our context just fine. Or in other contexts, think of king in terms of even our whole government or 3 branches of our government, the judicial, legislative, and executive, as you know. So some of the verses need adjustment for our differing context, but it's important to note that when Proverbs talks about a king, it's not necessarily prescribing a king as a kind of government for us today anyway. Of course, in the Old Testament, that was what God set up. He gave them a king. So Solomon's not only writing as just describing what's the norm for their day, but he is, yes, also prescribing what kind of government is anticipated to be had among God's Jewish people. But in the New Testament, we have a different story, and we have to make adjustments for that in our context to know that Proverbs here isn't describing for us, New Testament Christians, a monarchy. We shouldn't read through Proverbs or any part of the New Testament and say, well, let's get out of here. Let's go find a small island somewhere, and we'll find the best guy among us and appoint him king, and at least we'll start off on the right foot. We can start doing the Old Testament again. No, we're not going to go there. So let me give you some other examples of the differences related to a king. For one, there's a lot of information on getting on the good side of a king and staying away from the bad side of a king because he could kill you. Proverbs 14:35. Look at that. The king's favor is toward a servant who acts wisely, but his anger is toward him who acts shamefully. So favor toward the wise, anger towards the shameful. You kind of, what side of the sword are you going to fall on with the king? Are you going to be defended by the king, or are you going to be the enemy of a king? Proverbs 20, verse 2, just listen to this. The terror of a king is like a growling lion. He who provokes him to anger forfeits his own life. Now, how does this relate to us in our U.S. context? Unless you believe in conspiracy theories, a U.S. president cannot have you killed. As far as I know, unless you believe in conspiracy theories, as far as we know, on the face value of it, presidents can't say, take him out, guys. He can hurt individuals politically and socially. He can step on people in order to get to the top. He can change policies that may hurt people or may even hurt the nation. But he can't just whimsically knock off somebody. But the king can. The king in Proverbs is really a guy who decides what's right and what's wrong based on what he thinks is right and what's wrong. That's why in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 9, it's a big deal to get invited to come before the king. He who is skilled in his work, it says, will get to come before kings. And this is true even of presidents today, right? Whenever anyone wins the Super Bowl or the Stanley Cup, by the way, Stanley Cup playoffs start next week. I'm sure you're all wondering, and now you know. That information is there for you. Red Wings and Predators in the first round. Tune in. Okay. that aside, winning a pennant, winning major league championship, you get invited to see the president, don't you? Proverbs talks about that. You're good at something, you get invited to see the king or the president. Another example, the proverbial king is warned about drinking a couple of times in Proverbs, chapter 31, verse 4. He's warned about drinking on the job specifically. And of course, being impaired impairs judgment. So the implications are obvious. No king should be on his throne coming up with laws while he's liquored up. But what isn't on the surface of things, what isn't so obvious, is the context in their day of what would happen as a king would drink. It usually was connected with laziness. The king, you can picture it, right? You've probably seen it in movies. The king in his fancy garb, all the gold around him, and he's got the chalice, and he's drunk because he can. You know? He can't. Who's going to tell him he can't? Who's going to say he has to get to work? He's the king. And so with a lot of kings, you had both drunkenness and laziness going together. Now, we, thankfully, cannot imagine that happening with an American president. His cabinet and his staff wouldn't let him loaf, I don't think. I don't think they would cover for him if he was a fall-down drunk. And, you know, I think we would notice with some public appearances if he was off, if he pulled a couple of Paula Abduls and showed up a little tipsy in the morning. I think it'd kind of catch up with him, and we might say, you know, I don't know if that guy should be handling the red button with the nuclear warheads, you know? Another example of a different context in Proverbs is that Proverbs assumes that the king spoken of there will most likely, he will most likely believe in God. He will most likely want to obey God. He'll know that he should obey God. Now, we can't assume that. Obviously, for every country in any age, we can't assume that. We can't assume it for our country in our age. So sometimes you have to go to Proverbs and ask it, what does this say for me? A subject, not the king, but a subject when I personally want to obey God, but when the king or the president or the majority of the Senate are really working from a different worldview, from a different source of authority. You have to tease out what it means for us when a lot of times our leaders don't want to obey God, don't think they have to obey God. And lastly, we have to keep in mind, like many things in the Bible, when Proverbs is talking about government, it's not giving us a manual on how to do government. It's giving us principles. It's giving us principles for rulers and principles for their subjects. And it's very unspecific if you really want to get technical. You look through what Proverbs says and what other parts of the Bible say about government, and it's very unspecific. It's almost like this stuff is applicable to whatever kind of king you have and to whatever kind of government you're in. As the New Testament deals with government, especially, it could be applied to a context where there's a good king or a good president or a good Senate or a bad one. And so we have to keep in mind there's no manifesto here in the Bible on how Christians are to engage politics exactly, let alone how a government itself is to operate. Principles, but not a full picture, not a manual. Okay, the second thing of introduction are some basic principles about rulers in Proverbs. And by the way, when I say rulers in Proverbs, we're going to look at verses that talk about kings. But these are leadership principles, so it'd be almost equally true of any governor, any mayor, any business owner, really. It'd be true of parents, you could say, because they're leaders of kids. Well, they should be. It's true of pastors who are to lead the church. And so it talks about kings, and it's definitely giving us a priority that the higher up you go in authority, the more important these principles are going to be. Right? So the more you're in charge of, you could say, the more important it is that you're righteous, or the more important it is that you're wise, all these kinds of things. It's that basic principle, to whom much is given, much is required. But think of this in terms of our national leaders and kings in history, but also think of it in terms of you're probably a leader of somebody. So this applies to you. Take these principles and apply them to your leadership, because they'll help. One, rulers are called to a higher consciousness and carefulness in thought and in action and in righteousness. They're called to more thoughtfulness and more carefulness, more awareness of what they're doing and how they're living. Proverbs 16:12. It's an abomination for kings to commit wicked acts. The throne is established in righteousness. Proverbs 20, verse 28. And we'll be flipping all through this, so you might just want to write down references rather than try to get to the reference in time. We'll be back and forth all over. Proverbs 20, verse 28. Loyalty and truth preserve the king, and he upholds his throne by righteousness. So rulers are called to a higher consciousness and carefulness in their thoughts and their actions and in their righteousness. Secondly, it's the king's glory to search things out. That's what Proverbs 25 verse 2 says. It's the glory of God to conceal matters, which, by the way, just tuck that away, very parenthetical. Proverbs says it's God's glory to conceal matters. We seem so surprised when we can't figure out God. We seem so surprised when there's a doctrine that's mysterious to us. It is his glory to conceal matters to us. We don't want a God that we totally get because he's just like you. You don't even get you, really, right? Your wife says, why'd you do that? I don't know. Instinct or something. You know, we don't get ourselves. We're not going to get God. But the rest of the verse is, the glory of kings is to search out a matter, to search out what's right. Think of this in terms of the judge. It's his glory to search out what really happened, to get to the bottom of things and not be whimsical like, nah, that guy seems like he's nicer. He must be right. You get the lawsuit. No, the glory of kings for laws, the glory of kings, we could even put in this context of Proverbs with godly kings or kings who know that they should be godly. It's their glory to search out biblical matters. It's their glory to search out God's ways. They were to be experts in the law. They were to soak themselves in the law, God's word, as they were appointed king. Thirdly, the purpose of government is to protect the good and restrain the bad, personally and societally. That means with people and with programs, or with individuals and with policy. It's the government's business to protect the good and to restrain the bad. That's true of our Declaration of Independence. That's true in Scripture as well. You find it in Proverbs. You find it in 1 Peter 2. Proverbs 20, verse 8 says, a king who sits on the throne of justice disperses all evil with his eyes. He's looking for evil and he's looking to disperse it, to either deal with it with punishment or to deal with it by putting them out of the land, throwing them out of the city, excommunicated from the city walls, you could say. His job is to protect the good and restrain the bad. That's why government exists. Fourth, a king, or really a whole government, in some ways represents God and his ways to people. It represents God and his ways to people. There's a sense in which he is a mediator. The king is a mediator of law and provision and order and peace and justice. And as he gets those right, he is mediating on behalf of God, sometimes not consciously. So you could have a king who doesn't believe he's acting on behalf of God, but as those laws are just and as those laws are moral and as those laws are good and as those laws meet needs like for the poor, care for the needy, then he is on behalf of God mediating God's business to the people. Proverbs 16:10. A divine decision is in the lips of the king. There's something about the fact that when he's speaking a divine decree. Now, he's either getting that right or getting it wrong, and so as he's getting it wrong, God doesn't stand behind it. But his mouth should not err in judgment, Proverbs 16:10. Okay, so these are some basic principles about rulers in Proverbs. We've qualified it, and we've given some basic principles for leadership in Proverbs. But now let's look at three main points which seek to solve some kind of dilemma or some kind of tension or answer some kind of question as we stand between the book of Proverbs and our own 21st century American context. First, the first is this: government in light of sovereignty and responsibility. Let's think about the government in light of sovereignty and responsibility. Remember this theme from a couple of weeks ago: sovereignty and responsibility in Proverbs. Two things that are equally true, held in tension. Not that God is 99% sovereign and we are 1% responsible, or that it's 50-50, or he's sovereign for some things and we're responsible for other things, but mysteriously, we make real decisions with real consequences. God doesn't make us do evil, but somehow he's in both the good and the evil. And one of the things we saw as we looked at that theme in Proverbs is that God is sovereign over the appointment of kings. Now, you could say on a human level, that guy's king because his dad had a son, and that's it. There's the human explanation. Or that guy's president because this many people in these many states voted. Red states, blue states. This is how it came out that this person's the president. Okay? That's true. That's the human explanation. But behind every single one of those, there's a divine explanation that God said so. He is sovereign. You think of Exodus, where God says of Pharaoh, wicked Pharaoh, "For this reason I have raised you up to show my power and my glory through you." Not, "For this reason I am addressing the person who's in charge of Egypt." Who is it again? Oh, it's Pharaoh? It just happens to be Pharaoh. No, "For this reason I raised you up to this point because I wanted to show my power and my glory." Specifically in the person who leads Egypt. Specifically in the nation of Egypt. But also in specifically you, Pharaoh. Remember what Jesus said to Pilate as he was on trial? Pilate says, "You're king? I'm a king." And Jesus says, "You have no authority except what's been given you." No authority except what's been given you. He doesn't say, "You don't have any authority." He doesn't say, "There's no such thing as human government. I'm the king and you don't really exist." No, he says, "You are a king, but there is no authority except which has been given you." It's not just the appointment of leaders. It's also the direction of nations. So Proverbs 21:31 says, "The horse is prepared for battle, but it's a stupid thing to trust in. The battle is not won by the strength of an army. The victory belongs to the Lord." Or Proverbs 21, verse 1, even down to the decisions of the king. "The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes." Water in the hand. Is it going to spill out on this side of the hand or this side of the hand? God turns hearts like that. He's sovereign over nations. He's sovereign over their rulers. Remember Cyrus? Isaiah 44 to 45, if you want to read the context, there God says that he plans on using the wicked Gentile king Cyrus as his man or his anointed. Anointed. That's a word used for Jesus. Jesus is God's anointed. Cyrus and Jesus aren't the same thing, but God has purposes for using Cyrus, a wicked king, even in doing wickedness. Remember what his wickedness is? He's going to be the guy that brings a judgment to the Israelites, rather to Judah. He is going to be God's instrument. He doesn't know it. He's not trying to. He's not planning to. But he's going to be God's instrument to bring judgment to God's people by bringing them into captivity, by beating them in war. God says, "He's my anointed. I have purposes for it." Just like God will use King Artaxerxes in Nehemiah and Ezra at the time of the restoration. Cyrus and others were the ones that brought him into captivity. Now King Artaxerxes is the one that frees them from captivity and sends them back to their land. He doesn't really do that worshipfully to Yahweh God, but God has purposes for him to do that. Government is to be thought of in terms of both responsibility and sovereignty. So a side note is, don't not vote in our culture because, well, God's going to pick his man anyway. Not only do I not want to vote because I'm only one vote, and if it really came down to, oh my goodness, it was one vote. If, you know, this guy had gotten one vote, then he would have won, and I didn't vote, I feel bad. Otherwise, I don't feel bad. I'm going to say I'm going to go vote and then really go shopping from work. That is a nice convenient break, isn't it? So some of you sneak off, perhaps, and don't vote. Don't do that. And don't not vote because you think your vote doesn't matter, but also don't vote because you think, well, God is sovereign, he has his man, nothing I can do to thwart that. That's true. But he also ordains the means, not just the end. He ordains who's president, and he ordains who votes for him. He moves in hearts and steps in such a way that, really, it's not just the end is his goal, and he'll get his end, that guy in the office, but he'll do it even without the votes. No, he does it with the votes, right? So we vote. Turn over to Romans 13 with me. I want to show you a parallel passage in the New Testament. By the way, Romans 13 is probably the longest New Testament passage about government and how we relate to it. And where Proverbs mostly talks about a king, what the king should be like, Romans 13 doesn't talk almost anything about the king except how we, as his subjects, relate to him. And subjects may sound like, well, that's for a monarchy, that's not us. Well, we may not be subjects under a monarchical king here in America, but we are in subject to authorities. We are in subjection to authorities. You don't think so? Just go ahead and appoint yourself a police officer and try to do police work and say, what? I thought it was a democracy. I was just, you know, there's no real authority here. It was just a democracy, and so I just plain police officer. You go to jail for that. You get in trouble for that. My friend tried it in high school. He had one of those cars that looked like a cop car, and so he thought it'd be fun to put a Navy shirt on and pull people over. And he found out that's a really big no-no. So you can't do that. Romans 13, it tells us how we relate to the government, and the thing we'll see first is we are in subjection. Everyone's in subjection to somebody. We are in subjection to authorities and rulers over us, even here in our democracy of America. So Romans 13, we'll read 7 verses here. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have oppressed will receive condemnation themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what's good, and you'll have praise for the same. For it is a minister, a king, a senate, a congressman, a policeman. He is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what's evil, be afraid. For it does not bear the sword for nothing. It doesn't have a means of punishment for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it's necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, because you might get punished, but also for conscience sake. We should know it's right. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them. Tax to whom tax is due. Custom to whom custom. Fear to whom fear. Honor to whom honor. Now keep in mind, as this is written, the first century context is this. Nero is the emperor. Nero. This is written to Romans, right? And Rome is, that's the capital city of the empire. So Nero may actually even read this letter. Or maybe his advisors will read it at least. I think Paul's sensitive to that. I think he wants to at least let the Romans know. Let Nero and his minions know. Listen, Christianity has no agenda to overthrow this government and then be its own government. We have an agenda to be godly. We have an agenda to see people believe. We have an agenda to see Christ's glory spread in this world. We do not have an agenda to set up an earthly throne. In fact, our message is this: be in subjection. Submit. Why submit? Because civil law is an expression of God and His law. It says it in verse 2. You might want to note that our Declaration of Independence at a couple of points, this is like a homework assignment if you're even interested. The Declaration of Independence on a couple of points says things like, we believe these things to be what? Self-evident. It doesn't. Notice it doesn't say, we believe these things to be rooted in Romans 13. It's appealing to something that's within us. And then it goes on to say, in the pursuit of life, liberty, and what is it? Pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That if you don't think this is right, just throw it off. You can throw it off. And there may be something there that's operating from a slightly different model than Romans 13 itself. It may be. I don't know how you view the history of the founding of our country, but it may be a deism there. There may be a bit of a deism that these things are self-evident and we operate according to human rights, not according to the Bible. There's no mention of the Bible there. There's no mention of Romans 13 there. There's no mention that this authority is given from God. In fact, what it says is that this authority is given from the people. Now, is it true the authority is given from people? Yeah. And is democracy probably the best form of government? Yeah, Churchill was right. You know, democracy is the worst form of government, he said, except for all the others. It has its problems. It is probably the best, but notice the difference here in Romans 13. God gives government and law as an expression of Him and His law. He appoints authority. People really, ultimately, finally, are not the appointers of authority. Because you know what? It's really hard to make big changes. It's really hard to overturn government. What if you wanted to make the change? No more two-party system. I'm sick of this. I'm sick of it coming down to only two people. It's a beauty pageant, and it seems like they're both really ugly. I don't want to have to choose either one of those. I want like a, 10-option system like they have over in England. No, you just try to make that change. I mean, even if you became a senator, it's going to be a really hard thing to change, right? So know this, that where you can't make those big changes, God is sovereign. God is in it. He appoints authority. We also see in Romans 13 that it's for our good to have government, and the government bears the sword on behalf of God, not in vain. So we should obey because it's for our good. It's for society's good. It's part of loving neighbor as self. And really, there is a legitimate threat of the government doing wrong, sometimes wrongly, but usually they get it right. Usually they get it right, and so we're thankful for that, and we tell ourselves and tell our children, watch out. You should be afraid. The guy's got a gun on his hip. Don't go and push him down or something. Push him to a bushes and then run off laughing. Don't do that. Don't do stupid stuff with cops, like egging them. When I was a kid, I repent. Don't tell my kids. Other places we could go in the New Testament, like 1 Peter 2, which is on the front of your bulletin. Maybe you'll read that together as a family at lunch. You'll have it with you. By the way, because God is sovereign over kings, precisely because He's sovereign over kings, there are times when we obey Him, not government. There are times when we obey God, not government. When this law conflicts with this law, we as His people, as Christians, we go with God's law. It is better that we obey God rather than men. Acts 5:20. With a law over the disciples saying, quit going around spreading this thing. Pretty much you've been given a law and a warning and the threat of judgment here. You go around preaching like this and stirring up trouble, there are going to be consequences. It is better that we obey God rather than men. Think of the three Hebrew children in Daniel 3. You didn't bow down to the golden image, the giant golden image. King Nebuchadnezzar, we don't even need to give you a reply. That is a gutsy answer to the king. We don't even need to give you a reply because our God's able to save us from the fiery furnace. But even if not, we will not bow down to your image. In fact, the book of Daniel, we did a study on the book of Daniel not too long ago. And you'll remember it's a story filled with case studies on when God's people should go along with everything going on in an ungodly government, an ungodly nation. And when they should dig their heels in and say, we cannot do that. When you still go up to the upper room with the windows open and pray towards Jerusalem like Daniel did, even if it means being thrown in the lion's den. Do not put your hope in men, though, or in a nation. Put your hope in God. Do not put your hope in a nation. How hard must it have been for first century Jews who came to believe in Jesus as the Messiah for them to get the message, do not put your hope in nation? Because there was that huge anticipation of the Old Testament that God was working through his people to be a nation, to be a politic, to be a government, to have a land. And in Jesus, that stuff gets fulfilled in a spiritual way where now we're the temple. Well, now his people are made up of Jews and Gentiles who believe in Jesus. Where now the promises are for a spiritual kingdom that's not of this world, Jesus said. How hard must it have been for them to wrap their arms around the idea that Jesus is king, not of a politic, not of a government, but of a nation and a people that are not of this world. So we trust that God is on his throne throughout whatever comes to pass. We trust that wherever injustice seems painfully apparent, I think our system is pretty good. It's probably better among the rest of the nations. Our judicial system and our system of checks and balances and these sorts of things. But where it goes miserably wrong, we trust that God's in it, that he has mysterious purposes for it, and that our courts are not the final reckoning. Our human courts are not the final reckoning. So, you know, maybe you sued somebody, and it was one of those, this is right. It's not about me getting the money, but it's right. This is noble. I'm not suing another Christian, but I'm filing a lawsuit against this guy because he needs to be stopped, and it's right. This is justice. And then it doesn't work out. There's not enough evidence, and you know what's right, but it didn't turn out to be right in the courts. That court is not the final court of justice. Be encouraged. Psalm 118, verse 9 says, it is better to take refuge in the Lord than in princes. It's better to take refuge in the Lord. So let's get to this second point, government in light of legislation and morality. Government in light of legislation and morality. There's a complicated relationship between law and morality, and we're going to tackle it in 7 minutes or so. First, let's say this, God is glorified. Here's a nugget to put to the side, kind of a preface to where we're going. God is glorified in justice and not just the justice done by Christians. Does that mess with you at all? God is glorified in some ways in justice on a bigger level than just the person who was in charge of that justice. God can be glorified in the justice of an unbelieving judge. Not just the justice done by a Christian judge. So the goal is not for us to get just Christians in office. If it's an unbeliever who has tremendous political ability and experience, or Ryan Kelly, please vote for this guy, even if he's a Mormon, Jehovah's Witness, whatever. If he says he's an atheist, I would say, personally, vote for the guy that at least has some experience rather than this pastor. Well, he prays. Well, at least he'll do devotions before he signs anything. Yeah, and I'll sign stupid stuff too. You know? Be thoughtful about that. Proverbs 11:1 says, a false balance is an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. A just weight in some ways, has no reflection on the person who owns the weights and the scales. A just weight is his delight. I think God is more glorified in the conscious doing of justice by those who want to see it done worshipfully. But God is still glorified, and sometimes it's the best we have to see justice done even by non-Christians. Also, laws are not arbitrary, but they're often consistent with God's revealed will. Laws are not arbitrary. Think of murder. Think of things that fall under the Ten Commandments. Murder and stealing. Why is that inerrant in our culture and in so many cultures? Because it's not arbitrary. It's an expression of what Romans 2 says. There's a law written on our hearts. Even an unbelieving senator, there's a law written on his heart. He has some sense of what's right and what's wrong. Now, we have an explanation for why that goes crooked sometimes. Because they suppress the truth and unrighteousness, also in Romans 2. But they can't totally suppress it. The law is written on the heart. And even with other Ten Commandments, like lying. Lying to your neighbor, that's not punishable by law. Lying in a courtroom is. Not just for convenience sake. There's something inherent, and that seems wrong. You know, adultery. If you commit adultery, it's not punishable by law. But it doesn't help you in divorce court, does it? All of a sudden now, that still is something that's frowned upon, even among unbelievers. So the question arises when you talk about law and morality, should the government legislate morality? The first answer to that is, well, yes, what's the alternative? They should legislate immorality? I mean, they already do legislate morality. Unless you think there's no such thing as morality in this world. We can go down that path if you want to, but if you believe that there's something called morality, then there's no way in the world you can think of laws that are governmental that don't have any moral value whatsoever. They do have moral value. But should the government legislate morality? My answer to that would be no, if what you mean by that is to try to get unbelievers to act like they're believers so that we get back to a Christian nation where Ward and June Cleaver look nice. Where Ward and June Cleaver don't watch MTV or something. I mean, fill in the blank of whatever you think is the thing corrupting our culture. And you think if we can get them to stop doing that, if we can get teenagers to stop spray painting and cussing, if we can get, you know, gangs to be obliterated, and instead these are clubs for niceness. If we can get there, what? Then what? It's a bunch of nice lost people. They're still lost, and their lostness will evidence itself in other ways. We simply shouldn't be surprised when unbelievers actually act like unbelievers, despite what our history is as a nation. Despite how you think our nation was founded, whether Thomas Jefferson was a deist or whether he was a believing Christian, solid, just like us in his Bible interpretation. Whatever you believe about that, I think we can agree on this. There is far less Bible consciousness now than there was 100 or 200 years ago. So we shouldn't be surprised when that less Bible consciousness actually shows its ugly head, both in pop culture and in politics. We shouldn't be surprised. Even if you think this was a Christian country at its beginning, the fact of the matter is that more senators today don't read their Bibles than they did before. We shouldn't be surprised then. And let's admit, something has gone terribly wrong when the non-Christian American culture equates evangelical with a powerful vote. Something has gone terribly wrong when non-Christian American culture thinks of evangelical first and foremost with a political agenda. Or even that political agenda pursued in harsh, condemning tones. Something has gone terribly wrong if they think evangelicals are the ones who are angry and they vote. We've gotten off our message, and we've gotten off our mission where that's the case. Christians should be known for charity. That doesn't mean being wimpy, but Christians should be known for charity. They should stand up for truth in loving and humble ways. Not an us versus them mentality, which forgets that we are them. We've just been redeemed. Oh, it's so easy to think, I got it right, and you're stupid. It's almost like charity with differences in the church, sure. Charity with people who don't yet believe the gospel, my friend that doesn't believe the gospel, and I'm trying to tell him what Jesus did for him, and trying to get him to believe and see and hear and like it and love it. And we're patient, we're humble. But when it comes to politics, for some reason, we seem to put on our fatigues and go to war and be nasty and be prideful and haughty and say, it's us versus them. We are them. Because the battle lines aren't drawn merely across the aisle or whether you like to ride on donkeys or elephants. We have to consider how our politics relate to real issues, which means things like Christians should be known for charity among our own ranks. Some of you have had maybe a small group and a Democrat showed up. And you were like, what? Christian Democrat? Or vice versa. Some of you Democrats came to this church and said, what? I'm kind of getting a sense like you guys are really against abortion. We are. We are. Lovingly and humbly we say that. We believe it's wrong. I'll mention a little bit more about that later. Well, let me mention it now. Christians should be those who care for the poor and for the unborn. Christians should be those who care about racism and who care about euthanasia. Proverbs 24:11 says, deliver those who are being taken away to death and those who are staggering to a slaughter. Hold them back. I think that that's referring in part in our context to the lives of the unborn. But I like what Huckabee said. Now I can mention his name because he's out of the running and we as a church don't like to say, vote for that guy. But I liked what Huckabee said when abortion was an issue in one of the debates. He said, it's not just an issue of that life. It's also an issue of the life of the elderly. It's an issue of the importance of life for the poor. We, of all people, should be people who care for life in general. And one of those expressions is with those who are not yet born. We should be a people who search things out. We should be a people who don't vote Republican because Stephen Colbert is funnier than Jon Stewart now. And some of you don't have cable and you don't know what I'm talking about. Google it. Unless you don't have the internet, then I'm sorry. Don't vote in a direction that just helps your bottom dollar. Don't vote for someone just because he's a good speaker, if you know who I'm talking about. Vote like one who has legs, one leg on this earth and one leg in heaven, because we have a citizenship in heaven. Vote like one who has a king who is Jesus. Lastly, and quickly, government in light of Christ and his kingdom. Let's think about government in light of Christ and his kingdom. Let's start here. We need government, and we should thank God for it. It's a mark of our own fallenness in this world that we can't figure out how to get along, and we can't figure out how to be peaceable and just be remotely civilized without people over us telling us what to do and posing some threats for what we shouldn't do. It's a mark of our own fallenness that we need government. And it could be worse than this. For whatever our government isn't, praise God for what it is. It's easy to do this in the church, isn't it? You think of all the things the church isn't, all the things that are wrong with Desert Springs. Man, if we would only just spend more time thinking about what it is, we'd be happier, more peaceable. Thank God for what the government is. Thank God for government in general. And remember, in biblical history, human kings are actually a mark of us deserting God as king. Remember that in 1 Kings? God is not surprised, but he expresses his disappointment and shockedness when the people say, we want a king just like all the other nations. What they're actually saying is, yes, peer pressure, we want to be like every other nation, but you know what? That seems more sensible than us getting our laws from you. They're breaking kingship authority with God to have a king like the nations. And ever since then, God has not been ultimately the king giving law explicitly like the other nations. There have been human kings and human presidents and senators and congressmen. And further proof that there's a problem is our outrage and our disappointment at all that is wrong. Which isn't wrong. It isn't wrong to be outraged when injustice happens. It isn't wrong for us to grieve over the inadequacies of our political social structures here. But I think we do it in a way that maybe is hypocritical, that forgets that we really want justice for everyone besides us. It's really easy to think, since none of us obey the laws of the land perfectly, you might speed, you might use your cell phone still, you might not buckle, you might skimp a little on the taxes, whatever it might be. Since none of us are batting 1,000 on the laws of the land, it's really easy to just say, well, we should get stricter for everyone here on over. And I'll stand right here. Here on over. This stuff? Oh, it's petty, it's small, everyone does it. We want to get more strict for everyone over here. And that's hypocritical. It's hypocritical also to play Monday morning quarterback when it comes to politics and think that we would do better. It's easy to say you wouldn't put your foot in your mouth through so many speeches. But as one who speaks a little less than our president, but still a good bit, I stick my foot in my mouth every Sunday. I have the taste of rubber sole constantly in my mouth from this job. And man, I wouldn't want everything I say to not just be recorded, which it is, but then to be recorded and played nationally. And then when it gets messed up, boy, that's the thing that really goes in the highlight reels. That would be hard. It would be hard to have to make that decision of whether or not to go into Iraq. Not with the information we have now, but the information they had back then. It's really easy even for senators to flip-flop, isn't it? And all of a sudden say, yeah, I didn't think we should have gone. But you did. You voted for it, right? Really easy for Americans now to say, I was afraid of this. Well, you didn't tell one single friend you were afraid of it. And now you play Monday morning quarterback. The fact is, friends, no human leader will bring shalom or peace. None. None. Some seem to have just realized this. And so they're disillusioned with the candidates and the political system. Some maybe even won't vote this year because you're so disillusioned with the two candidates, or, well, two eventually. And you're so disillusioned with the political system. You say, why bother? Why bother? I mean, to me, let me just encourage you with this. To me, that sounds awful 23. Like, I just started voting the last election. The first one, I didn't care. I was like, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. And then the second one, you get serious. And you're like, I'm going to get into it. And then by the third one, you're going, oh, crud. I don't know. It stinks. Just, man, I wish there was a better guy. Is this really the best we got in all of America? Right? Are you sure Arnold can't run? Because he was really good in that movie, and tough and gentle, Kindergarten Cop and Terminator. Don't we know by now you just got to vote for the better guy, or that you find the worst guy of the two, and you go, okay, not him, it has to be the other guy. That's all you got to do. Which guy's the worst? Okay, then the other guy. That's your vote. We shouldn't be surprised because Proverbs is calling for a king, listen to this list, who cares for the poor, who upholds justice and rules mightily, who's a strong warrior with a strong army, who preserves truth and disperses evil, whose terror is like a lion and he should not be provoked, a king who's full of glory, whose heart is unsearchable, who doesn't err in his judgment, who's not given to change. We need a king who gives life and his favor is like a spring of rain. We need a king that will not die, because every king who's even great has eventually died. The Old Testament kept anticipating a king, one who was going to be eternal and reign perfectly. And Jesus is this long-awaited king. Jesus is the perfect proverbial king. So please do not be surprised when George Bush puts his foot in his mouth. Please do not be surprised when our nation elects the wrong person in your mind. God is on his throne. He's not left it. And please do not be surprised when the one you voted for then becomes a moron. Don't be surprised. It's almost like we want every election year to be a Messiah. The Messiah already came. And it's done. And he reigns. And we don't yet see all things under his feet, but they are there. They are under his feet. He is reigning. He's ruling and reigning over a people like this, his church. He rules in hearts every day as he convicts of sin and changes lives. He rules over death and sin and Satan. He rules so effectively, Satan doesn't burp without his permission. He changes hearts, not just policy. He is educating. He is purifying. He is making peace. He is reforming. He is our commander in chief. He is the captain of an army that would obliterate our nuclear warheads like they were like just little bottle rockets. And he's not done. He's not done. He's coming again. And when he does, he'll make all things new. That's our hope. It doesn't mean we don't do politics. It means we put politics in its place under King Jesus. He's the king.